Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast.
April 19th, 2026, episode 296, Taxable. Hello, everyone. Welcome into the corner, the Beekeeper's Corner. I'm Kevin England. April is meandering along and the May apples are up in the yard. Have you ever seen these? We have them in spades. I'm going to guess they call them May apples because customarily they rise in April, but they produce their namesake apples in May. You know, as it is, our yard is awash with wildflowers, and we negate cutting the grass until they run their course. I suppose it could look a bit unkempt in anyone else's property, but, you know, we live in the woods. And I look at our spring abundance as I pull in the driveway and think it looks lovely in its natural state. Trees are in bloom, flowers are doing their thing, and all is right in the world of beekeeping. Well, kind of. I'll talk about this later, but it seems things are a little slower this year, as far as progression goes. But we just had some really goofy 80-plus degree days. One day it got to 88 degrees. Almost 90 degrees in April. I think our plants are somewhat confused, especially since there is a frost warning this week. But it kind of bears out the notion that every spring is its unique compendium of circumstances. But here I am going on about the weather, just like meeting a stranger and not having something to talk about. And I really do have something to talk about, so maybe now would be a good time to tell you what's going to be in the program this go-round. First up, using deck material for building bottom boards. Good idea? In a roundabout way, if they don't manifest unforeseen problems, then yeah, I think the juice would be worth the squeeze. Number two, a new way to measure how honeybees are doing with varroa mites. It's called the Bowden Essay, and I suspect you'll hear a lot about this as spring turns to summer. Number three, supersedure. A small aside about the word and some interesting behavior from the bees that could lead to unintended consequences. The namesake of the episode, do you have high taxes in your bee operation? I'll explain the notion and discuss how taxable could be weighing you down. Zabaros. Honeycomb cappings is a health aid. Zabaros. I illuminate what it is and how it fits into an additional way we might use products of the hive in our everyday health. There's a local hive report to sum up a few things, and we'll close it down with appropriate closing comments or two. Kevin at BK Corner is my email. Show notes at www.bkcorner.org. ManageMentoring.com if you are looking for more support in getting started in beekeeping. Feel a little bit lost? Come and join us and we'll try to help you out. And well, that's it. Let's get tucked into the show. Roundtable number one, UltraDeck homemade bottom boards. A curiosity showed up on YouTube that made me go off into a contemplative moment about the pros and cons of homemade bottom boards. Just last week, I was working with some colonies in the outyard at Valley Crest and saw that some of the bottom boards in service were a little soft and starting to rot. And yeah, maybe I'm going to get another season out of them, but I need to put that on a to-do list. If you think about the work a bottom board has to do, as far as the pieces of equipment go, it bears a lot of the burden of a beehive. It has to be strong enough to hold all the weight above it, and it has to be durable enough to deal with moisture-laden refuse that sits on its surface for quite a bit of days of the year, especially if beekeepers don't take the moment occasionally to clean off debris off of its surfaces where they collect. I took my colonies apart this spring in my main yard, down to the bottom board so far, to purposely scrape off collected bits of wax and other detritus. to get rid of residual moisture that sits on the surface. Even if you're running screened bottom boards, the coroplast collects it, and then it sits against the wooden frames, and it's working at degrading the wood all season long. That belies the focus of this roundtable, which is a bottom board designed by beekeeper Don Chesek, C-H-E-S-A-K, that is constructed of UltraTech composite boards. The video, aptly entitled How I Assemble My Homemade Screened Bottom Boards Using Composite Decking, goes through a step-by-step process for how to manufacture bottom boards out of the durable decking material. When it comes to the durability against wood rot, this product scores an A+. When it comes to the dimensional oddities that are a part of the manufacturing process of composite decking, there are some challenges to be found. If you've ever looked at composite planks in the store, they always tend to have a little curve and undulation to them. Dimensionally, they're not very consistent. And when you're building something like a bottom board, you have to overcome the peccadilloes of the substrate you're working with. When you're working with lumber, dimensionally, it's very predictable. And it also has a well-worn path when it comes to fastening and fabrication. If you've ever worked with decking material, it's a little bit different of an animal. It doesn't cut the same, it doesn't screw the same, it wasn't made to mate up in the same way that wood joins to wood. And to his credit, Don has recognized the idiosyncrasies of this and has designed the bottom board to overcome any potential problems. He also aptly shows you how to construct one in a step-by-step manner that makes it clear and approachable if you're a little handy with shop tools. In the case of his process, clamps are your friend. Now, when it comes to projects like this, just because you could doesn't always net out that you should. I think of a few things that I know about decking materials, specifically that it's very heavy, and its ability to carry weight without transforming in a way that would be unacceptable, meaning warps, splaying out, all of those other weird things that happen sometimes when you place it under load in specific ways, could go in a bad direction. I will say, through power of observation, that the bottom board that Don came up with looks like, under the duress of the hive weight sitting on top of it, that it's going to pass the test. It seems quite capable and quite sturdy. And of course, he shares his endorsement after having used many, many previous iterations of the design of the bottom boards he's created using this process. Kevin, moment. 1 year in school, either Sharon did a project with her students or the kids built a planter to bring home on Mother's Day made of composite materials. My guess is somewhere, somehow, somebody was building a deck and had all this stuff left over, and that item sits out in our garden, and when I look at it each season, I revel. It looks as good as the day it was made. And in our garden, when it's the off-season, it's laying in the dirt, sometimes covered in moist garden mud and schmuck, and it's never, ever none the worse for the wear. Environmentally, that gives me pause. But when it comes to durability, well, let's just say it's years and years and years old, and it shows no signs of falling apart anytime soon. End of Kevin moment. I'll have a link to the video in the show notes, where he shows you how to build a screen bottom board version of it out of this material. When I say he was thorough, do note that the video is 30 minutes plus long. But the video is very well made. The angles and the shots and the audio are really well produced. And it will ensure that you can get through the entire process and absorb his tips and suggestions. If I'm not mistaken, I believe he mentioned that it would cost somewhere around $50 in materials per bottom board. In comparison, these days, a screen bottom board can be, what, around $25 to $35 or more from a B catalog? And, yeah, this one's $50 in materials and your time to fabricate it. Is it worth it? Well, what is it worth to have a super sturdy high bottom board that will serve you for many seasons? That's a question you have to answer, but it looks to me to be a job well done, and kudos to Don for sharing out the plans and design for others to take advantage of. Look for the video link in the show notes. Roundtable number 2, Bawden SA. A listener to the show and an active participant in our managed mentoring program asked me the other day if I was familiar with a Bawden SA. B-A-W-D-E-N, my short answer is no. I was wondering if maybe I had heard of it and forgot it, or if it was simply something I was not familiar with. It turns out it is an emerging varroa management test that is likely to be something that beekeepers are going to add to their toolboxes, and I suspect in due course that it will be a process that sits with other peer approaches like the Harbo assay or the alcohol wash that we're probably all very familiar with. Oh, by the way, Kevin Moment, assay. I say the word, it rings a bell for me. In my early years, I would hear researchers say, assay this and assay that. I didn't have a clue as to what it meant because the term was foreign to me. Eventually, I gleaned it was some kind of test or research process, but it's still locked up in my brain every time I heard the word. And truth be told, I hate saying the word. I just don't like it. It's one of those words that doesn't feel good in the mouth. So if you're in that camp, here is a layman's term of the word assay, spelled A-S-S-A-Y. It is, in a nutshell, a structured, repeatable way to measure something. If I expand on that, it's a scientific test that tells you how much of something is there, or even if it's not there. And it often infers how well something works or is performing. So an assay is often a formal tool with rules to follow, especially when it comes to deriving comparable results. End of Kevin Moment. And so it turns out that this Bawden assay is a combination of two things in execution. And for a little background, this is the way it works. You choose a frame of brood you wish to test and confirm that the pupae age for your test subjects is correct before conducting the assay. And I should state for the purpose of clarity, there's more detail to this test, this assay, and that perhaps is for another show. But I simply want to introduce and mention this here. I'll provide a link at the end in the resources so you get a sense of what this thing is without getting too complicated. When you have your brood frame selected, you use a novel piece of equipment for beekeeping. I think this is the first I've ever heard of it. A wax depilation strip. Yes. If you know what that is, you heard me right. A wax depilation strip. They're sold in stores for hair removal. There are kinds for facial hair, body hair, full body kits, and so on. And the short answer is, you press one of these wax depilation strips down on the cappings of the frame you selected of the pupa of the right age, and you pull it back, whoosh, removing the wax cappings off the cells. And all of the pupa, that were under the square of the material that had adhesive over it are exposed. If you did it right, size-wise, it nets out to about 200 pupa to sample. 200 cells are uncapped. Now, after performing the whoosh operation, you turn the frame over and judiciously bang it against the surface to eject and dislodge the contents of the open cells. By the protocol, you should do this on wax paper. You then dump the bees that were under development into a container and do an alcohol wash. There's more to the process. Additionally, you want to inspect the content that is now in the empty cells for the presence of varroa mites and varroa mites in development, as well as you inspect the capping material stuck to the strip for different properties. Look for varroa mites. You can take the cappings, put them in a zip-top bag, take them back and look at them through a microscope. Under examinations, the cappings can be inspected for signs of capping and uncapping behaviors by the bees, and you can make notes of that as you go along. When taken in aggregate, this process, which is still in design apparently, and review, it seems to net out a similar result to the painstaking work of alcohol washes and Harbo assays that take quite a bit more time and effort. And the results of this test are so close as to be, I'll use a word, negligible. The summation of the process in use states, quote, this comes right from their website, the Bawden assay can be used to screen a yard of 50 colonies for their levels of VSH mite resistance in an afternoon, compared to the days it would take using the Harbo VSH assay, end quote. It goes on further to manage expectations with perspective that Harbo is the gold standard, and that this method would serve as, quote, a highly streamlined process for first screening and identifying colonies with mite resistance breeding potential, end quote. Here's where I say, interesting stuff. I get it. And thanks to Gordon for sharing this. And I'll have a link in the show note where you can go look at more information. Now, before I go away from this roundtable, I want to take a moment to share a sentiment. I've been missing for a few weeks because of this very post. It's taken me down a rabbit hole. I might have mentioned that I'm currently authoring a queen rearing course for our local association. One of my goals this year is to run it as a prototype, and if it works out as planned, I would like to host a fee-based online course and offer it to anybody who wants a good baseline on queen rearing. There's not a lot of training in that aspect in our area. I have spent the last 6 months developing the queen rearing course, and between that and supporting the work of the beginner course I teach and manage mentoring for getting started in beekeeping, I've been burning a lot of midnight oil lately, building training content. But this assay, I just started after reading this. It pricked my pranging bone. I decided to start a little research process on the history of varroa-sensitive hygiene, VSH, and suppressed mite reproduction, SMR, among other things. I don't understand it. And while I say that out loud, I know what it is, but I don't understand it. I equate it to something similar to asking someone how to perform a DeMarie method for swarm prevention. Lots of ideas out there, and most of them are patently wrong. And there was a time when my pranging bone got binged for a DeMarie method. I did not like not knowing if I had it right or not when people asked me how to do it, so I did a deep dive on the history of the process. And I went back to learn what Davery designed, and learned that what we do today, what's often described in the textbooks and common modern approach, is not the same thing. We have a hybrid approach. Ours is better, by the way. We've evolved the process and it works better. But I digress. Harbo, Hoopinger, no, not Hoopinger, Hoopengarner was the name, Harris, they established and evolved the VSH-SMR baseline. And I've been spending hours going back into archives and tracing the lineage of the evolution of the process of these tests and assays and such in order to have a foundational grasp and not some speculative made-up understanding from passing conversations and sound bites between beekeepers and snippets out of a beekeeping presentation. I have to say, wow, what an interesting study this has turned out to be. It's a laborious labyrinth of concepts and ideas, and it's based on, and most research is, going back in the work and standing on the shoulders of other research that came before it in foundations. Why would I go do all this? I'm positive that one day I'm going to take all this that I learned about it and distill a timeline to bring back to the show. I don't know how that's actually possible, but that is the motivation for this. It's also a motivation that when I stand there and talk to people in the know about these processes, I'm with them in understanding the right information when having a discussion about this as queen rearing and other things go. I want to do an overview of VSH and SMR from a solid base that is researched, not from some AI summary cobbled together and completely wrong. And by the way, I did ask AI, and it's completely wrong. It's got parts and pieces, but the cohesiveness and the accuracy of how it all lays out, it just can't figure it out. I think beekeepers should have a foundational knowledge. And to my eyes, there's very little out there. There's not some place with the history of this that ties it all together. I think it would make a really neat presentation too, the history of the Harbo assay and what it means and how it evolved, and have a factual research base to do that presentation. So if you want that, let me know, because someday I'll have that. Harbo has a website that summarizes what he did, but it's summary. And given I'm a Y guy, I want to know more. And the cool thing about it is the USDA has an archive of all of the research papers that they wrote while they manifested the process, and you could trace the steps of it, which is what I'm doing. Yeah, it's a journey. And now you know a little bit of what I've been up to on my free nights when I'm not producing a podcast. Back to center, Bawden assay. I'll have a link to resources that has an overview of the work underway. It seems to show good promise. I can't imagine why this would not be something that everybody's going to know in time. And I have to say thanks to Gordon for introducing it to me. Roundtable number 3, supersedure. I just said the operative word to examine for this roundtable, supersedure. I want to give you a moment to consider something. How do you spell that word? Yeah, I'll take pause while you consider the matter. Supersedure. The proper spelling for the word, whether it's to supersede or supersedure, is with an S, as in Sam. Yeah, S. Who knew? I have tons of notes going back in time where I've documented the word for some purpose or another, in presentations with other beekeepers, in my writing, in books. And yeah, it's not spelled that way. It's spelled with the letter C in the middle. And if you're like me, do not feel alone. because I've always spelled it that way because that's how I came to know it. Now, in layperson's defense, especially how American English takes liberty with the motherland's English from England, it might seem natural to spell it S-U-P-E-R-C-E-D-U-R-E. The connection for us comes from something we associate with it, seed. To seed something, the seed aspect of the word. If we think about it, seed can conjure up the notion that supports the idea that this word would have a C instead of an S. Seed, spelled differently, C-E-D-E, is the word that represents cessation, to stop. If that's not convincing, take a singular and make it a plural. And there's also some like examples that we're intimately familiar with. Proceed to procedure. They look absolutely the same, don't they? Supersede, S-U-P-E-R-S-E-D-E, means to take the place of. The S-E-D-E component of the word stems from Latin and represents the notion to sit. I don't know why that has any correlation with take the place, but that's what it means. Now, this might be the worst segue in history, but since we're talking about supersedures, let me take a moment to share some learnings about the actual dynamic of a colony faced with replacing a queen through a supersedure. Consider maybe that the queen is not performing her duties, and somewhere in the worker bee pool, a number of them have pulled the trigger on grooming a replacement. Their task, since they chose it, is to transform an everyday worker larva into a queen that will emerge and presumably replace the reigning queen, with a little help from the workers who would join in to conspire in their replacement. As it is, supersedures can take place at any time of the year, and when they take place in the spring, it might be indifferent. They're going to choose a larva, and the good news is, when they choose that larva, there's plenty of food coming in, plenty of drones present, and it could be on par with a swarm cell, and you would be none the wiser. The benefit of a supersedure taking place, say, early in the season, and it does happen. Imagine a queen, at the end of her run, comes out of spring and she's now forced to become an egg-laying machine again, and she runs out of gas. They'll do a supersedure, but at the best time of year for that to occur. The end result is a supersedure cell that's on par with a swarm cell. No problem. Nothing to see here, citizens, move along. But that's just not always the case. And part of it comes with two factors. One, what if it's not spring? What if it's the middle of the dearth of summer? There's not an abundance of bees in development, and the workers have limited choices to make for their larva selection, and they choose poorly. What if that larva grows up to be a queen and goes out to be mated, but there's not a lot of drones around because it's the end of the season? What if during the duration of that larva, as a supersedure cell developing, the food supply is not that great, and it ends up being a runty queen? All these things can apply, but there's even one more insidious thing that can occur. The worker bees, in their haste to choose a larva, will look, and in this case, sometimes it is known that good enough is perfect. In an ideal scenario, they're going to choose a larva that is hours old, just transformed from an egg to a larva that can either become a queen or a worker. And when fed from the get-go with the perfect food supply, become whatever they're destined to be. But sometimes in haste, especially in an emergency situation, the worker bees will catch as catch can, pick a larva, and if it's a day or two old, maybe even older, They'll choose it. In fact, they might choose a bunch of them. And let's say, for illustrative purposes, you have four workers that select four different larvae to become queens. One of them, they choose a worker that's 2 days old, already in development, and they switch it. Stop. We're going to make you a queen now. Where the other ones all choose one that is in hours old development, meaning it just transformed and it's going to make a really good queen. Think about the timeline progression. The larva that got chose from worker number one, poor choice, is already 2 days old or 3 days old. It's going to get a limited food supply of worker jelly for the first couple days and then worker food. And then it's going to be transformed to royal jelly until it goes all the way to capped and done feeding. That one, because it's days old, has a terrible start, and it comes out first. And the queen's going to come out and go around to the other ones that got started, which haven't emerged yet, and cut holes in the cell and kill them. She wins, not because of quality, but because of timing. Now, occasionally the bees are in on the mix, and the worker bees might sequester that queen and allow the other queens to come out and choose one of the other queens, because somehow they know. But it is highly plausible that that first one out of the starting gate that got chosen from a several-day-old larva is the queen of the colony. She goes out, she gets mated, she comes back, and because she didn't start from inception to be a queen and wasn't fed properly and didn't develop right, maybe she ends up being a dud. It's an insidious cycle because she's going to lay eggs while they decide this one's not it either. We got rid of the old one. We replaced her with this one. She's no good. We're going to replace her. What do they choose? They choose her larva, which is inferior too. And you go in this downward spiral. So supersede your cells and emergency cells. Sometimes beekeepers go, there's no difference. They're fine. They're great. Don't worry about them. That's not necessarily true. If you had the choice to know whether you could use a swarm cell, which is built for the purpose of replacing the queen during swarm season with the optimal conditions, or choosing one that you have to live with because it's a swarm or an emergency cell because you squished the queen, you should play all this through your math. Do the math. And here's the thing. If you have a supersedure cell or emergency cell, because of what I just described, which happens sometimes, not all the times, you know, quite a few times those queens just come out and they're perfectly fine and suitable, and you move along, citizens, nothing to see. But if your concern is the time of year or any of those other factors, it might be better to walk on down to your local queen rearer who has a high-quality queen mating under optimal conditions and pinch the queen cells and get rid of anything that's underway and put in a proper queen. Supersedure. It's spelled with an S. Roundtable number four, taxable. I want to share a notion that came to mind about beekeeping that's been bubbling under the surface as I make my plans for this year's beekeeping season. It has to go with my latest take on the perception of mainstream beekeeping messaging today. It's out of control. I don't know about you, but maybe it's just me and the circles I move in. And of course, I'm so plugged into social media. Self-inflicted, I might add. But there's such an overwhelming abundance of beekeeping guidance and advice coming these days that I don't know how to process it. Do more. Do more. Do more. Do this. Do that. Do the other thing. It's good for you. You need to do this. Do more. And yeah, Isn't that the pot calling the kettle black? But I digress on that point. Actually, I want to say for the record that I personally love exploring nooks and crannies. I don't mind seeing people say do more. Doesn't mean I have to do it. And living vicariously through others and gathering the depth of knowledge, you know, sometimes it helps you to experience the deep dive into our craft. Other people's doing the hard work and you're able to see what they got going on. But when it comes to do more, I exhibit quite a bit of constraint about what I actually do when it comes to my management practice in the bee yard. I don't think this phrase applies, but kind of like do as I say, not as I do, that type of thing. It's backwards. I do as I do and I don't do as I say. Meaning all these elaborate things that I talk about. People think I do all this crazy stuff. No, I'm a pretty pedestrian beekeeper. I'm sensible. I never feel compelled that I have to follow suit with the latest fads and crazes. And honestly, a lot of that comes from the pure happenstance that many things suggested in this world would require too much time. And time is always in short supply. I don't have time to do it even if I wanted to. I'm for simple and not complicated, practical and common sense. This is the compass I follow. Case in point, and not to pick on this world or hold it up as folly, the whole quality queen stuff has been a thing for me. I've been pretty consistent on that, magic queen this and magic queen that. I will state for the record, you can have high-quality queens that are thoroughbreds, but be real, the queen you have, the queen I have, in my backyard is a mutt. Hopefully it's a good one. Good breed. She's a common, everyday queen. She's not a $1,000 one, but she's getting the job done. And as a general rule, everyday beekeepers don't have access to thoroughbred queens. Unless they go out of their way to do more and get them. Pay $1,000, go to insemination people and things like that. I want you to think of all the beekeepers in your area, and I want you to do a quick survey of what you know. Even if you wanted to do more, how many beekeepers in your area are making queens, thoroughbreds, that you have access to? And now that you've thought of that, how many of those queen providers are going the extra mile and providing queens that have assessed, meaning they're going the extra mile, VSH and SMR traits through Harvey assays and pin-kill brood assays and things like that? Now, doing the same thing I just asked you, I might think that my zone, what would I know to the answer? What's the answer to that? I know maybe one or two in my zone, somebody I could call up today, get that from, and know that they're doing the due diligence. But that's few and far between for the bazillion beekeepers who are in my region that have access to those same people. And even if I go outside of that zone, I know even more. But it's a hard sell to think that you can get on a list, given the high demand. And that's do more, right? You have to really fight for your place in that. I don't know. You see, it's just not that common. If you're the ilk that your operation can't persist without a magic queen, well, good on you. But what a tax you have put upon yourself to have that capability. And that's the crux of what I want to talk about. Using that as the jump-off point, I could think of other facets of beekeeping that beekeepers chase today. I call some of this stuff the power of acquisition. You long for it. You chase it. You love the hunt for the kill. And when you bag whatever it is, magic things are going to happen in your bee yard with your production capability or some other aspect of your operation. Power of acquisition is powerful. I will admit, I have my weaknesses. I have a burden to carry. For example, there's one area of chase that I permit myself to operate in, and it's taxing my operation. I use some alternative hives. It requires a different know-how, skill set, know how to treat these things, different equipment and feeders. I could be standardized. I have to say, sometimes I bask in the glory of staring at my Waré hive, because man, it's a cool hive in the yard. Power of acquisition, baby. But I know what it cost me. What a tax I have endured. And other times I ask myself while staring at that, like, should I stop doing this? That's where I am right now. Should I stop doing this? Why do I do this to myself? When I look out at others, I see a spectrum of behaviors. And I can have respect. Some beekeepers are really constrained. I know one person who shall not be named. Dyed in the wool about the process. Dyed in the wool. X time of equipment used. No other exceptions. This is the type of equipment I'm using, period. X ways to manage the bees during the season. X number of colonies under care and not a colony more. And, you know, I have to respect and say there's a certain elegance to that. Not complicated, whatever. Constrain, however, can be a tax in a different way. But, you know, I suppose if you had to choose a simpler path, standardization is a fairly attractive way to go. There are other taxes in beekeeping that go another way. Maybe your honey harvest yields X number of pounds of honey. Let's use that as an example. Year on year, X number of pounds of honey. And you process it using the same method you did the year before, and the year before that, and so on. You recognize that part of your process could be better. It's a burden, and you don't like it. I speak from experience. We did that for a number of years. And ultimately, we solved that by buying an uncapping device. This device, which sits on the table and you work your frame over it while you're uncapping, captures the wax cappings and the honey as you're slicing it off. And when I say it's drastically better than the method we used before, we would never want to endure the tax of going back to the way we did it before. And think of all those years that we lost not having one of those. And what a vast improvement in our process. So this is a different way to look at it. Lack of process, progress, improvement can be a tax. Do you have any of those? I suppose what I'm getting at here is to close this down. What are your taxes? What taxes your operation? How do you find deductions, both pro and con, in your beekeeping practice to remove constraints, burdens, outmoded practices, discomforts, inefficiencies, and the host of likewise things that could make your beekeeping less taxing? April 15th is the tax season in the U.S. We just moved past it. And I think one thing whenever we do our taxes, which we just completed recently, what should we do differently this year? So next season, the starting pistol for next year is now, this year's beekeeping season. Start assessing the things that you want to change that tax your operation and make a plan for a better tax season as the years go by. Roundtable number 5, Zabros. This is a term that I'm going to guess has been around for some time, but I'm just discovering it. Zabros is the word that describes capping comb, specifically the cappings that cover honey. I cannot help but think of Toys R Us. And if you remember the connection, then you'll remember how to spell it. Z-A-B-R-O-U-S. U.S. I want to equate it, what I see about this product of the hive, to a practice that's more prevalent and centered on the Eurasian continent, as most everything you read or see in videos is presented in languages other than English, and if you really want to look at it, you kind of have to translate things. Think Ukraine, Russia, India, and other areas within that region. They're on board with this as a product of the hive and have experience with Zabrus. This harkens to me to be something that's in the realm of extended products for apitherapy, especially when you dig into some of the purported benefits of consuming this wax. And yes, that is the background of the practice. You take the wax off of the honey and you specifically clean it of honey or not, as some show, and you eat it, something akin to a supplement in your diet. Or you chew it like you would chew some chewing gum. Think of it as a close cousin to people who chew on propolis. When you find literature describing why, it's often espoused that this wax is special in a few ways. And if you're in alignment with what is shared, the manner in which the bees construct the comb is different than honeycomb used throughout the rest of the interior of the hive equipment. This particular wax is touted as superior in that it is imbued with biologically active substances in complex forms. And the underpinning of those beliefs is that in order to cap honey, honeybees know they need a different formulation in the wax. And as such, the wax that they're using, one is brand new fresh wax most of the time, it's pure and it's a different formula or mix than the standard run-of-the-mill wax. In folk medicine, it is taken for ailments in the mouth and digestive tract. Infections in your mouth, colds, sinus problems, digestive issues. Due to higher levels of wax esters and low levels of hydrocarbons and free fatty acids, it's described as cleaner than the rest of the wax in the colony because it's the first fresh, clean wax flakes from the bees. And of course, its freshness means less tendency to contain pesticides and other contaminants. And interestingly, some of them say it's not in contact with pollen and propolis, and others say that they pull pollen and propolis in and mix it in while they build it as part of the special formula. Apparently, there's varying thoughts on that. Now, to take advantage of the wax, one of the things you could do is just chew on it. Take a small chunk of wax and chew on it, and as you do, you gain the benefits of its constituents. As you take this piece into your mouth and chew on it, pass it around like you're chewing a piece of chewing gum, and a couple things happen. Your saliva glands activate, and this begins the work at coaxing out the constituents in the wax. Additionally, you might get traces of honey if you didn't wash it off. Sugar consumption gives you a little energy. And the glucose breaks down, and as it breaks down from your saliva, it creates things that are beneficial for you. But more importantly, the microparticles of plant products that are within the interior of the hive and part of the bees exude when they make wax are released into your body. Which, you know, kind of, if I think about it, if you have any sensitivities, you're kind of training your body to cope with plants that your body might have some sort of reaction to. And yes, people say this is akin to a homemade allergy deterrent mini infusion of your local plant, flora, and fauna. Kevin moment. When people say that eating local honey helps them with allergies, The factoid that I just relayed about chewing this stuff is, I think, what happens to some extent. As you eat honey, or in this case, chew on the wax, or let go one step further, you eat propolis, as some people do, your mouth and digestive system is getting microdoses of plant material stored within these products. Now, some scientists and researchers in the medical condition community are clear that honey does not help you cope with treating local allergies, because when anything helpful in the honey gets down into the digestive tract, it is unequivocally destroyed by stomach acids, and it doesn't stand a chance when it comes to being distributed throughout the body as some sort of medicinal helpful thing. I guess in many respects I could see that. If you think about how tough pollen is to break down, what it takes to break it down so it could be absorbed into its constituent parts, when it gets to stomach acid, it either can or can't break it down, and then it might destroy everything because it's an acid, and it never gets to the point where it can be absorbed. But I have to believe, at the microparticle level, that things do get absorbed through the membranes and linings of your mouth, your esophagus, as you are making, as whatever it is making its way down the digestive tract. A case in point, a former boss of mine had a son that is allergic to everything. Everything. Now, typically, I don't say things like that, everything. But his allergies were so grandiose and all-encompassing that it would be easier to name the things he wasn't allergic to. The boy's quality of life was compromised so much that going outside during the day often led to unintended consequences and events due to coming into contact with whatever compounds he was allergic to, just moving through the day. They had to do something about it, so they took him to a special allergy center in California. And after a battery of tests to determine all the things, the list was crazy, that he was allergic to, they put him on a regimen. They began exposing him to controlled microdoses of allergens. They moved through this kind, and then that kind, and then the next kind. They did this for years with him, often giving doses by mouth, sometimes topical on the skin. And after a few years training, his outlook and quality of life changed on miraculous levels. He went from boy in the bubble kind of thing to normal everyday person, as far as his contact with allergy stuff. It's stories like that that I think there are frontiers that we don't understand. And some might look at the notion of Zabris and consider it hippie medicine. But I would suspect that the truth lies in the middle ground. And of course, the practice has been around for centuries, end of Kevin moment. Now, one question about using this wax is, do you swallow it? Some say you do, and others say you chew on it and spit it out and discard it. There's a practice in certain areas of the world where in the fall you take a spoonful of this and you chew on it right out of the harvest with honey on it, and then you spit it out and you do this for a period of days, and this is your prophylactic to the cold season, prevents you from getting colds and such in the fall or whenever you're harvesting. Now, I've talked about this before on the show. It's mostly okay to swallow wax. You can eat it. Think about people who eat comb honey. Your body can process it, but from what I know, you really want to avoid doing it on a routine basis as it builds up in your stomach and, well, you want to possibly avoid that occurrence. Now, as to capping wax, is it special? I could speculate that the new fresh stuff is rather pure when it comes to the makeup of wax, and if the bees are imparting it with a special formula to hold in the honey, I'd never considered that. Is the wax that keeps honey at bay, fresh, clean, capped, protected, different? Do the bees do something different? Nobody's ever talked about that, but in these articles, there's some evidence that the wax is chemically different, built different. We can't see that at the molecular level. And that's an interesting curiosity that I'm afraid I don't have the answer to. So Zabar us. Now you know a new term for beekeeping folklore. Zabrus. I bet that's the way you pronounce it. I don't know. I couldn't figure it out because most of the stuff, I either had to read it or listen to it in a foreign language and have it translated. I never heard a person in English, U.S. English, say the word. I heard people in European English, broken English, say it, and I can't say it that way. Z-A-B-R-U-S. Something new to consider. Time to turn to the back of the book, Local Hive Report. This seems really strange for me. I feel like I'm still in a spring ramp-up mode. I have been through every hive on my watch and done the initial manipulations required for whatever presented when I did the inspections. This week we had two hives that were big enough to split and a desire to split them. That was the intended plan for them, and so I did that. Both were split to place half the bees in unoccupied equipment from a deadout. One split was a simple walkaway, took one box off, put it on the bottom board of the other hive, and took the excess boxes and put them over. And the other one was more in the tactic of swarm prevention. Talking about the swarm prevention colony, that's in the main apiary, pad number 7. It was an 8-frame polystyrene, 8x8 box, and it was loaded from floor to ceiling, wall to wall. When I did the hive inspection of that colony with the intent to see if it was ready to split, I found queen cells in progress, the first ones noted of the season. I'm not sure if I'm behind everybody else or that's what people are seeing these days. I can't really get a sense of that. I say that because timing-wise, for us and my historical notes, we're about a week, 10 days later than normal. We typically see hives loading in swarm cells in early April here. I do think that swarm season is going to kick in a little bit later after the cold spurt is done from next week. And traditionally here in this region, Swarmageddon starts April 15th, but it's been a rather slow start to the season. I think we'll go through this cold period, and then if we get a warm day, it's going to be game on. It's just a little bit laggy, and I'm seeing that in my colonies. Now, I have peeked at our bees here and there in the past few days, and I've also been peeking at my swarm traps, and I'm seeing scout bees, especially the swarm trap, the magnificent one in my breezeway. There's been scout bees checking them out. They're not left alone. They're kind of like kicking tires. The breezeway one is the exception, as it is every year. This swarm trap one day, it was 80-something degrees. Crazy weather this past week. The scouts in the entrance were so busy, I thought maybe I missed a swarm moving in. The scouts came pouring out between the frames when I took the lid off to see if there was a colony in there, like the jig is up. It was kind of comical. I, being sheepishly upset that I interrupted their process, quickly put the lid down and apologized for interrupting the work they were doing at checking things out in there. Now, turning to a different topic, I did something that you read in the books how to do, but I don't get the chance to do it too often. I relocated the Waray hive to a different spot in the apiary. Think 3 feet or 3 miles, that thing. Over the course of a few days, I moved it 3 feet each day. I moved it from one of the pads in the back of the apiary to the front of the apiary. Traditionally, I built a small little space for that particular hive to sit up front in our apiary. And last year, because of a swarm I had, I put it somewhere in the middle and I wanted to get it back out into its normal place. The move, I'm happy to report, went as desired. The bees figured it out each day where the hive was, and after a few days it's now in a different spot and it's business as usual. No muss, no fuss. I freed up the pad that it was occupying so I could put one of the splits I made in that location. As it is this season so far, I'm on top of my plan. Early splits were made when required. Honey supers are on hives that need them. And as far as I could tell, no swarms have gone out the door. I'm hoping that the expected buildup of colonies to production strength goes as nature intends. And, well, things remain healthy and productive, no queen problems. Everything's humming right along, and that allows me to turn to queen rearing systems. Queen rearing season, which I'm going to do at the end of April and early May. I should note that I did buy some Formic Pro and Naroa this week. I want to try Naroa. But I plan to hold off on using them until summer. There's a little logic behind that. I did contemplate whether or not I'm going to do some oxalic acid vaporizations early this year. I've been struggling with this. I see a lot of beekeepers doing treatments early in the spring to keep mites at bay. I'm trying to reconcile the fact that bees come out of winter with low mite thresholds, and I did treat last fall with oxalic acid vaporization, so I should have low mites coming into spring. So why am I dosing my bees with any kind of treatment early this spring? They should be relatively clean of varroa mites. Relatively being the operative word. If I do see something going on, poor brood patterns, do a mite wash and find high mite loads, I will opt to change my mind. But right now, I'm kind of going to let it roll. I think, and my experience tells me that, during spring, with the nectar flow, and the attrition of the bees in high rotation because of the way it works, they can handle any mite duress. But I could maybe change my mind. And I'm going to do something I haven't done because I've been treatment free, which is do some mite washes here as the season gets going and see whether or not I have varroa mites, just so I can know. Yeah, you could tell as I kind of ponder this, I don't quite have my plan locked in. But this is the thing. Mid-spring into summer, that's when intervention is prudent. And at that time, I am clear that I will be more diligent as I am every year. When mites are approaching peak population, and you want to get to summer solstice and avoid the perfect storm, and keep your bees clean to winter so that they overwinter well, that's when I will really consider doing treatments and such. That plan, as the season progresses, is a topic for another show. I am seeing the activity of beekeeping clubs pick up in the spring, as it usually does. And as it is, our local club, Northwest New Jersey, has 2 meetings on tap this week. Thursday night is our April monthly meeting. Mark Antunes is speaking on bees and flowers. And Saturday is our first field meeting. And I have that one circled on the calendar. I might skip Thursday because Monday night, Landy Simone is speaking at Raritan Valley. And I think I want to take in Landy. She's talking about weird techniques for swarm control. It stands to reason that spring is a good time to be a beekeeper. As like our friends in the hives, we too can be busy as a bee. Go take in a bee meeting. Refresh your knowledge, get your brain running, and have a good beekeeping season. Local hive report? Check. All's good. All is good. I think this is a good place to close the show down. I'm going to share, for the sake of saying things out loud, that the bulk of our remodel in our family room is close to done. We're painting, which is usually the final step. And Sharon and I are going to spend the early spring painting our garage while mustering to do the Mac Daddy job of renovating our kitchen space. It's going to prove an interesting and heads-down summer of beekeeping with the mix and priority of home renovation. Life is never easy, is it? There's always so many things going on. You know, taking on this home renovation has been a serious task. And when it's done, I can only dream of the time that I am going to have to do other things like normal people. Doing all this work yourself is seriously gratifying. Makes you appreciate the people who are in the trades that do this day in and day out, how good they are. But we're glad we went this path, and as such, it is an amazing reward to occupy the space that you had a direct hand in making. But fatigue is a real thing. I just wonder if I can find the ins and outs of the beekeeping season to get to bees. But I'm sure we'll figure it out. We've got a wedding this summer and a bunch of other stuff going on in family life, which will make it even more interesting. You know, given I'm off topic, it seems like a good time to call it an episode. I want to say before I close things down, if you're new to beekeeping and you need a little help, especially you've taken your beginner beekeeper course but you're a little uncertain about what to do, come join us at managementoring.com. It's free. We counsel beekeepers through the year. We answer all your questions, and it's just a community of new beekeepers or beekeepers seeking answers. There's an online meeting schedule on the homepage of managementoring.com, and of course you can visit the calendar of training lessons to go see what's coming up and get yourself in play. managementoring.com. If you want to sign up for meeting notices, go to the Start Here link on the homepage and sign up, and you'll get our newsletter announcing what we have going on. Like our beloved bees, when beekeepers go together, we can accomplish great things. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll catch you next time on the Beekeeper's Corner.